Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and whenever you are. My name is Kevlin Henney, and we are recording this interview at GoTo Amsterdam 2022, which has been delayed from 2020. But here we are at last, and I'm joined by Sander Hoogendoorn. What is it you're doing these days? Tell us about yourself.
Oh, yeah. Lots of stuff, actually. I'm really happy to be that we can get back on stages, right? That's really part of the joy in this industry. And mostly I'm the CTO for an e-commerce company, actually. And I'm trying to, move my team in the directions that I think they should move. And that includes both the architecture and the structure and how they collaborate and autonomy and how to write code and how to test and how to do TDD and DDD and all this stuff. And
so software development.
Yes.
Everything.
Yes. And I spent a lot of time writing code, actually. So it's, then I truly enjoy that. So it's.
So, yeah, and that really came out. So you've just done a keynote here, the Zen of programming. And there's a lot of talks which have the Zen of, but yours actually does actually work for that because
because
it was very much a personal journey.
Yes.
And it was very much the consistent themes of simplification. And rather than being a list of, you know, here's a bunch of, you know,
things.
Individual coherent things that are specific pieces of advice, principles or practice or whatever, is that it mixed a bit of that, but they were lessons. It was genuinely a story.
Yeah.
And out of it included everything from, you know, hey, monads, to yeah. Take your mother out more, you know, kind of. But actually there was a properly resonant theme on simplification. Really, that came through, which kind of like, I have to say, that was very nice. Code, most of which you said, yeah, this code, I touched it yesterday. And it was just that was very, very clear. But that constant journey towards simplicity is, you made some really interesting points about complexity to get to that. So that whole idea is the Neil Ford quote.
I love that quote, actually.
It's a fantastic quote. And, you know, developers are drawn to complexity like moths to a flame, and often with the same result. And that's something you see a lot of.
Oh,
why,
yeah.
Why do we do this? Why do we do this to ourselves?
That is a good question. I've been wondering the same question, actually, for years, I suppose. I don't know, actually. It's like we all do this, right? We are constantly saying, let's pick that up too, and let's do that, and let's try this too. And then it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. And then somebody comes up with a new framework or a new technology or whatever, and they're like, oh yeah, that would be a much better solution to do this before even having delivered anything, right? So we tend to add stuff to what we do before we actually push it out to business or to whoever, right? Which makes it more complex all the time. And and the problem is with complexity, you can never get rid of it.
Yeah.
Because it actually started this idea about not making it simpler when I was doing consultant for a large bank in the Netherlands. Well, I probably shouldn't mention the name, but they're here. Anyway, so, and that was years ago, by the way, and they had an 11-layer architecture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Made
That's
up entirely by architects who never code, right? And and there was no way they could ever deliver any software, right? So they took like a small project and it took 300 people for 2.5 years to actually deliver a small part of it. So that's the kind of culture that a lot of companies come from, right? And the second thing that also changed is when I stopped working for large consultancies, which is about 8 years ago. So I worked for Capgemini and for Ordina, which is a Dutch consultancy firm, and CMG, which is now CGI, I think. And they all make stuff more complex because, well, that's where the money is basically, right? So yeah. It's better to sell 300 people than to sell two. And also when I moved away from that, I stopped working for large organizations because they all have this culture of making everything more complex. And I wanted to go in the opposite direction, basically. So I started working for companies that became smaller and smaller and smaller. And that is, I like that a lot more these days.
There's an interesting thing there. There's two themes that seem to emerge there. One is the additive nature of how we try and solve things.
Yeah.
It's always by addition.
Oh yeah.
It's very rarely by removal.
We never take anything out.
And you made an interesting point in your talk about improvement of skill, is that there may be jumps in your improvement of skill, but often,
if
you look closely, there is a dip before that.
Yeah.
That what happens is that true learning doesn't come about purely by addition of knowledge. It comes about by reformation of knowledge. It comes about by unlearning and rewiring and throwing stuff out.
Having epiphanies. I like that word.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of moment, this ka-chunk.
Yeah.
Something happens and it's not always up. There's a down. We become less effective for a period.
That is because you have to try out stuff, right? It's the experimental phase.
Yeah. And that feels like if we want to get simplicity, then we're going to have to get better at the recognition that this is a learning exercise.
Yes.
And that means throwing stuff away.
Yeah. And that is exactly what organizations need to do, right? They need to start understanding that learning is basically the core concept of how we improve, of how we, well, but that makes sense, but how we get better at delivering software.
Yeah.
And not by repeating ourselves. There's lots of people who are in the industry that just repeat what they do all the time, right? And they deliver the same thing that they delivered all the time.
Mm.
But that's not, that doesn't make you better, I think. Mm. It's like, a lot of people say, this is what I can do, whether that's React or they can just build a functional component, or whether it's doing Java, right? Lots of Java, people in Java are building the same code or in exactly the same way as they did like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Spring One, basically, that's, okay, everything Spring and Spring Boot, and that's the way you write code, no discussion. And they like that, actually, which is really good. Those are the people, like my mom, right, who went to the same campsite for 25 years and never questioned whether to go somewhere else. And that's also good, because we need lots of those people in this industry as well. It's just not what I do.
Yeah.
It's like, I like to discover new stuff, and that's not about learning a new language, it could be, or learning a new framework, I couldn't care less, but it's about making code that is slightly more beautiful, more elegant than it was yesterday.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, in the 44 years that I've been doing this, there's always a step up.
And that's a really interesting one, because it's that idea of the beauty of the code. In other words, that idea of coming back to it, and there's kind of like, have I left something here that somebody else will appreciate, myself included, but other people won't curse my name when they come to this code.
They will.
But it's that idea of like, maybe they curse me less, you know. But our idea of beauty changes over time.
Sure.
We know more, we get older,
but that's the same with everything in life, right? So when I was 19, I used to date 19-year-old girls, right? And those were the best at those times. If I now look at my kids, and or the friends of my kids, I'm like, I would never be able to date people like this anymore, right? I'm much more happier with someone who, well, is more matured or more, well, aged or whatever you call it. But it is, we change our perspective all the time.
Yeah.
And also there's big steps, right? And big, there's these holes, right? I went through a really deep hole in 2009, 2010 when I got this huge burnout. And then I realized, it's the same. You add more stuff to your life and it's too complex. You cannot deal with it anymore. So you have to move back to simplicity. And I took a deep plunge and I sort of stripped out everything that wasn't really important or fun.
So that, and you mentioned that in your talk as well, that the whole kind of prioritization is just got to get back to what's all this other stuff?
Yeah.
Let's take, what are the things that I don't enjoy, that don't bring me joy?
And I literally ask myself those questions, like, what do I really enjoy doing this? If not, I stop doing it.
Yeah.
And that's, And I'm not sure a lot of people do that, actually. And that's okay, by the way, right? It's not worse or better. It's just what I do.
But I also think that plays out. That's a very, I guess most people don't do that most of the time. And when we do it, it's normally as a result of an event.
Yeah.
And it's just like, maybe I need to reevaluate things. But I think that also goes to the nature of how we work more broadly, not just personally. And I think that's kind of an interesting one. We're looking for, again, it's the additive thing. We add stuff rather than throwing things out, rather than asking ourselves, could we do this with less?
Yeah.
And that's that self-fulfilling prophecy. You talked about large organizations. How do you create a large system? Well, you work for a large organization. That will create a large system. You know, a large organization is incapable of creating a small system.
Yes,
And I think that's the interesting thing, is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, is that somebody says, we're going to have 300 developers on this. And you go, okay.
It becomes a goal, basically, right?
Yeah. The headcount becomes the goal. And somebody might estimate, for this architecture, we might need it. Well, the point is that if you chose half the developers or a tenth of the developers, you could probably also deliver something more effective. If you get 300 developers to deliver Hello World, it will be quite amazingly complex, probably with 11 layers.
Yeah, and it will probably not work.
Yeah. But the important thing is you couldn't develop a small version of Hello World with 300 developers. It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
So you're necessarily anchored at that scale, which is kind of interesting because you also talked about scaling. You made a couple of comments about scaling.
I always do that.
Yeah, you kind of quoted, Eberhard Wolf and the observation pretty much that scaling is the number one problem that people don't have. That is, and we are in an obsession phase at the moment, and we see it with things like Safe
that's scaling methodology. I think Eberhard was talking about scalability of microservices in that quote, but it's the same for organizations, right?
Yeah. But yeah, he was. Yeah, and that's the thing is that we get it with, again, is the number of people microservices. It's just like, and what are you looking to do here?
Yeah.
It's just like, and I had this exchange with a friend in Norway a while back, and he was just like, they're rewriting this architecture we developed in PHP, and now they're doing it in scalable microservices. The point is, our industry, our business is the same size. The industry is the same size.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
Yeah.
Why do we need that? He couldn't understand it. He said, Kevin, help me understand it. I couldn't.
Yeah. No, you have to do stuff for the right reasons, right? So that's why I basically, the question I ask my teams, and now they're asking it me, actually, is, so do you really need this? Like, with every solution that, one of the guys on my team came up with, we might introduce Kafka here. And I'm like, okay, so what problem does it solve? And he said, it becomes more scalable. And so aren't we scalable enough then? And he said, we are, but... even this morning in the stand-up this morning, one of the developers on my team said, I'm doing the tree shaking on our framework. And I'm like, okay, why? And there's nothing wrong with tree shaking, especially when you're doing Node, but it wasn't solving a problem. Because the problem he would have solved with it is everything would have gotten a little bit faster. Mm. But it is already fast. Nobody in the business will see the difference, right? So why would we spend our time, and why we have so many other stuff that we really need to take care of? And he was like, "Yeah, you're right." But my teams do it to me as well, right? I'm thinking, maybe I should remove this flexbox and put in another one, which is slightly better. They say to me, "Well, didn't the other one work?" Say, "Yeah, it works, but this one, it would be slightly better." I'm still doing it, by the way. But so I was like, two at night and start writing a new flexbox or whatever. But it's, we all do this, right? We all do stuff for no apparent reason, just because we think it's better, or it's better in the future, or later we will reuse it, which we never do. This is an industry, it's become an industry inside of an industry, basically.
Yeah. I think that's a really important observation, is that, particularly for those of us who end up dishing out advice, it's always to recognize actually half the reason we dish this advice out is that we know something about ourselves. We are as guilty of this as anybody else.
Yeah, very much.
But I think but you also asked the most important question there, which is, what problems does this solve?
Yeah.
And I don't think we ask that enough, do we?
No.
That is actually, and again, the architects who created the 11-layer system, somebody had stopped and said, what problem does that solve?
Yeah. And then they could, so that's basically, so that's why I said, well, you should always be able to ask the newcomer questions, right? It's like, always ask questions like this. So, okay, what are we going to solve this? Why do we do this? What does it do? And people forget to ask those questions all the time. It's like, it's because they're afraid to, because they are expected to know all that stuff, right? Mm. And especially when you ask the simple questions, because how simple can a question be? Like, what does this do?
Yeah.
What problem does this solve if we do this? And asking yourself those questions all the time helps. It saves a lot of time, actually, I think.
Yeah. I think that point about the tying back into learning, that what you're describing there is this idea, I guess I refer to it as the idea of like software development is a process of inquiry.
Yeah.
It's not a process of production, and you're actually quite strong about the idea of like, hey, we don't do production. Production is a word that doesn't, you know, productivity to be precise, is not a word we should really apply. We can use it in certain cases, but actually we use it too broadly, and productivity is not a helpful term. And here it seems that that's very much the same kind of thing. Is that we're trying to, it's a process of inquiry. Mm. Like we're trying to learn stuff. We're trying to, there's a whole bunch of stuff we don't know. We
stuff
don't
needs know to exact, emerge, actually.
Yeah, it needs to emerge. We don't know everything about the tools that we're using. We don't know everything about the problem domain, because if we did, then that meant we'd already built it. So what are we doing now?
Yeah.
You know. So therefore, it's a process of inquiry. And inquiry requires questions. And I don't know if we value that enough.
And it's hard to estimate.
Oh, yeah, because it's a process of inquiry. How long is this going to take? I'll tell you when I'm done.
So I had to explain to the, I think it's board of commissioners for the company I work for, like, why is it so hard for tech to do estimates? And I took the Kinefin framework, and so the CEO said, well, they're not going to appreciate your model, right? But I think, well, maybe they do, right? So explain, okay, if you're in the obvious or the clear context, there is a best practice. You apply that, done, right? But that's the stuff we can all do in this industry. And then there's the stuff that is in the complicated context, where we have a bunch of good practice and we need to choose one. So you do some analysis and you make it work and then you build it. That's the stuff that you can plan, right? That is, you can even do it in a waterfall style if you want to, basically. And then you move to the other side, whereas the complex and the chaotic zones where, well, practices at best emerge or are not present at all, meaning nobody's ever done that before, at least in our company. And so, well, we are now there on the left side where we have to question ourselves, so how are we going to solve this? We don't know. We're in the unknown unknowns. Yeah. That I shouldn't have said, by the way, because now the whole company is every time they're like, so how long is it going to take? Yeah, we don't know. We're in the unknown unknowns for everything, basically, right? They don't make the distinguished. But so the thing is, so what I explained to them, I said, well, okay, we are now here, right? But we're sort of in the middle between chaotic and complex. We sort of started to make some sense of what we're doing. Yeah. And then slowly the whole thing will turn towards being in the complicated zone, meaning when we've automated enough of the stuff that we now don't know what we don't know, it will slowly move towards the complicated zone, in which case we can estimate, right? So once we've got all the pipelines automated, we figure out how to do the performance on our microservice landscape, how to do how to deploy our apps to us, all this stuff that we need to take care of. Once it's taken care of, we can actually start making some more speed, because it moves to the complicated zone, meaning we will be able to estimate stuff at some point in time, and we are working our way towards being in the complicated zone. The nice thing about the model, I love Kinefin, by the way, is that it also turns, it doesn't stop there, right? You move from complicated into the clear context, meaning, oh yeah, I know how to do this, type, 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 done. But at some point in time, and that is, in my mind, when you reach the innovator's dilemma, is that you pass over from clear into complex again, because, well, you have to do something new, because what you did doesn't work anymore, so you have to reinvent yourself, and then you move back into the chaotic zone. And that's basically the circle of this industry, or actually of companies in this industry, and probably in most industries. And that's an interesting cycle, because if you realize where you are in that cycle, then you finally have some arguments to talk to management and say, sorry, we cannot estimate, and this is why.
Yeah.
And actually, they understood.
Yeah.
And I was a bit surprised about it, not because they're dumb, they're really extremely smart, but because managers in our industry and outside of the industry are used to looking at software development as if it is production. And like, why can't you estimate this? Well, because of the Kinefin framework, and this is why we're there. Or and they're like manage to say, how hard can it be?
You are, and you give them the answer.
Yeah, and well, it's hard because, and yeah, and they slowly get that, right? Yeah. And then, yeah,
it's about mental models. You know, yes. Is that a point? As you said, you've got a lot. There's a lot of smart people in this industry.
Oh, yeah.
in all different roles. It's not the question of intelligence. It's the question of the mental model that they bring to it. And we all bring mental models to things, you know.
Yeah.
And that is. And that's the problem, is that where those mental models and our language as well is it betrays the models that we sometimes, I mean, you know, we talk a lot about projects. I still do it, even though I've known that that is not the right word for many years. And it's just like, actually, most of what we're building is products. It's not a project. A project is something with a well-defined end state.
Yeah.
The, you know, software development is mostly about not ending. It's about keeping on going.
It's product, a journey. Basically. You know, that's why a roadmap worked much better. I actually persuaded the company that I now work for to, and I did that with previous companies as well, is to use the word roadmap instead of planning. Because it has a very different meaning, basically. Mm. Well, it still looks pretty much the same, right? But the roadmap is much more flexible in the sense that you can always change it, which we do.
And it may have more than one route.
Yes, that is the whole point. And yeah, right. And also that it's hard to estimate.
Yeah, and that's, I think that in other words, you're offering people enough information. You say, here's what we know at the moment.
Yeah.
Given what we know and what we don't know, here's what's possible.
Yeah.
And these are the paths.
Yeah. And set your priorities, please.
Whereas planning is a word with a very different suggestion, a set of suggestions. And likewise, project, well-defined end states.
Yeah.
And whereas product, the goal of developing a product is to keep on developing the product.
Yes.
You know, in an ideal universe, I mean, it becomes an infinite game.
Yeah.
And the idea is to always be developing. It's not, you're never, in one sense, you're never truly done. You know,
which
done means
it's
you retire the system.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So there's one point when you are done, that is, once you read, so I like the analogy of the innovator's dilemma, right? It says, well, you're building a product, it gets successful, you add more stuff to it, and eventually you go to a point where, well, adoption doesn't grow anymore, independent on how many new features you put into it, right? And that's where possibly another competitor or somebody from outside of the industry comes in, uses newer technology and goes into the same cycle, but has a head start where you are. So at that point, you need to either jump or die, basically.
Yeah.
And so you need to reinvent yourself. So that is basically where the gap is. And, and the funny thing is that I usually when companies ask me to join in is when they get to this particular point. They don't always realize it, and then when I show them the model, they're like, oh, fuck, we're doomed.
Yeah.
Actually, my previous client actually died. They added so much. They invented the smart thermostat like 15 years ago. And that was a great device, basically, but they added stuff to it like weather information, traffic information, on your thermostat, on the wall, really useful. And they had all sorts of features that, like, eventually they got to a point where they could literally predict when your washing machine was on, right? It was really cool that they could actually do that, but nobody cared.
Mm.
Now people slowly do, but it was too early, basically. And at that point, well, Google came out with their Nest thermostat, and Tile came out with stuff, and they were like, oh, fuck, they have this too, with cheaper technology.
Yeah.
And we're basically, we can't survive.
So that's kind of an interesting one. It's also, there's an idea there, that, again, going back to the cycle, there's a wave motion, as it were.
Yeah.
You're going through periods of consolidation. This actually kind of reminds me, based on what we've just been talking about, Henry Petrosky is a civil engineer and a historian, and he wrote this book, To Engineer as Human. It was published in the 1990s.
Cool.
Really interesting. And he talks about the role of failure in successful design. And he talks about this idea of industries, or particularly engineering, he focuses very much on that. You know, there's an experimentation period, and then something doesn't work out, and everybody, you know, you find a period of consolidation, things become very normalized and so on. And then there's the next, it's cyclic. It's just like, and then we move on to the next thing that's exciting and
which is pretty much what Weinberg describes, right? It's like the learning curve with the...
Yes, yes.
Cool.
Yeah, so there's this idea of in one sense, I think a lot of people are looking for stasis. They're looking for the one answer or the one thing.
Because
actually, it's a very dynamic thing.
Yeah.
And therefore, the kind of the map that you need needs to demonstrate these different domains of complexity.
Yeah.
But I think that that's, but that also probably tells us why there might be a little instinct in some people to, when they're adding stuff, part of our complexity comes from additive things. But there's also that idea, and you talked about it as well, that idea of future-proofing, or you know, maybe one day we'll do this. And again, not solving a problem we have today, but also not necessarily solving one we have tomorrow. But in our mind, that could be a tomorrow, and then we make it a commitment.
Yeah. And a lot of people think like that, actually.
Yeah.
But the most of us, I would say. But it makes it really, really hard So the problem is, if you build something now for something that might happen, what happens if it doesn't happen?
Yeah.
So what are you going to do with all this added complexity in your code? You're never going to take it out again. And that's why you end up with 11 layers of architecture, right? But so not putting it in the first place, yeah, it's just way more effective. But it's contraintuitive, I would say. People find that really scary. And especially developers, that we want to make everything more generic, right? That's what we do. So actually, what I love the most is writing frameworks. Yeah. It's like there's nothing more enjoyable than writing a good framework, actually. Yeah. But so I've been doing it for most of my life, actually. And but you always have to, even doing that, always limit yourself to what is now necessary. So the open source framework that my team and I are now building, which is an open source TypeScript framework for building microservices, is actually we only add stuff after we've used it. It's not before, so only after. So we now build whatever. What did I do? Oh, I added something on the gateway class to Mongo earlier this week, and it could have been there a year ago, but we hadn't needed it, and now we see the need for it because we see stuff in our code. We say, okay, what if we would have that in the framework? Then we wouldn't have to write this code anymore. We wouldn't have to write any tests for it because the framework would already cover that. Okay, let's do that, and then we'll add it to it. And then somebody from the team will add it, and it grows organically from stuff that you actually do.
So it's empirically driven. This is a real thing as opposed to you know, maybe what if.
Yeah. There's no what if.
Yeah.
There's also no if statements in the code, actually. But
we'll come to that in a moment. Yeah. So there's an interesting thing again about the that approach that you're describing, which I think is quite important in terms of how we drive the development. If we have the what if approach, the danger of of what ifing is that the better your imagination is, the more what ifs you have. And therefore, the more complex. You know, if you're a person of limited imagination, then it turns out
the world is easy. Yes,
the world is easy. You might still get your what if wrong, but there's going to be a lot less what ifery.
That is a very nice observation, actually. So that would suggest that people would. Yeah, it's actually. I think this is a very true observation.
Yeah. So the more imagination, the more complex it could be, the more generic or whatever it might. Yeah.
It is it's probably coming from long, long ago, being able to, when we still lived in trees or whatever we did, right? It's being able to go through more what-if scenarios would help you survive, basically.
Yeah.
It's a very basic instinct, that probably.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that explains where this comes from, but it doesn't tell us that we need to, but our temptation there's no harm in the what-if questions. The problem is we then commit them into a piece of code rather than say, you know, that's really interesting, let's hold that one and see if it happens. And, you know,
it's an interesting realization to figure out that it probably comes from, a survival mode, basically.
Yeah.
And the more possible dangers that you can, you can meet with is helping you survive. So it's probably the people, really early on, right? It's probably the people with the most imagination who survive longer.
Mm. Yeah. So there's an interesting thing there in terms of when we think about, you know, things that make a good developer is actually being able to think through lots of different scenarios.
Yeah, yeah.
And be not surprised. So therefore, it's a positively selected for trait in the industry, but it clearly has a potential failure mode if we're not aware of it.
Yeah.
In that sense, we overcommit. What if? Well, let's put it in the code. I don't know. It's great to ask the question, but maybe. And I think that's the interesting thing is this idea, again, coming back to being able to ask the question. And there's a question that's being asked there, but we put it in the code without ever asking it. Whereas what you were valuing in your talk was asking the question out loud before, you know, actually being able to ask that question is probably more, is far more important.
Also to ourselves, right? Being able to ask those questions to other developers on the team. It's not only just business, but it's also just the developers on my team. And the nice thing is, because if I would have been a manager, then asking those questions get a very different, connotation to it, right?
Yeah.
But because I write the code myself, I can actually ask those questions. And it's easier to, like if a developer, the situation this morning where they were doing tree shaking, well, we actually don't need it. We'll probably need it at some point, probably, but we don't know, right? It's fast enough now. And, but because I could have done this myself, I could also fall into the same trap and have done stuff that I really don't, which I do all the time, by the way, but, and it's writing the code yourself that allows, it makes it possible for me to ask those questions to other developers because they know that I do the same things, right? I make the same mistakes. And
You're real and you have skin in the game in that sense.
Yeah, I guess.
So, you've taken us into the code. Let's talk about the code because you mentioned basically ifless code. Let's talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
So, paradigms. So you're working primarily in TypeScript.
Yes.
So
I love TypeScript.
So and you showed a whole load of TypeScript earlier on the slides. And so how would you characterize the kind of the style and nature of the code at the compositional level, you know, at statement to the function level? How are you thinking about the code?
Well, first of all, it's all asynchronous, right? So it's there are microservices, but also apps, so we're using React as well. So most of the code we write is in a promise, which basically means you then and catch and et cetera, right? So that means that, well, a promise is a monad, and then it becomes tough, right? Because you have to explain people what a monad is, which is, according to Douglas Crockford, impossible to do once you get it. I would probably say that my style of coding has evolved into a highly monadic, call it functional, but pure functional code is a little bit harder to write or also to read, actually. But it's moved away from, let's say more procedural code.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking about it differently, and that took place over the last probably 7 to 8 years. And it started when I was the CTO for an insurance company and we did Java and we were writing basically the first microservices architecture here in the Netherlands. So late 2014 or early 2015. And there was a guy on my team and he actually came with the try class and he got it from Scala and Scala has a try class in it. And he's like, what if we would port this to Java? And so lots of the developers on the team, so I had a big team, like 40 people, and they were very traditional Java developers, right? If you look at the code, you open it up and it's like, if, like 10 levels deep, right? And I'm like, how do you test this stuff? And they're like, yeah, we do integration testing. Yeah, okay. But there's probably lots of exceptions that you probably missed along the way, right? So what if you don't do that? And then he came up with the try class and we ported it to Java and the first, a couple of weeks that I looked at it, I had no idea what it was, right? It was so very much different from how I was used to writing code. And we started out with saying, okay, what if we put this in a try? Okay, we'll put it in a try. Well, there's no try catch blocks anymore. Okay. And then what if we nested throughout the layers in the architecture? So meaning we pass the tries all the way up and down again, and then only in the end we evaluate what happens. And the code became so much more, shorter, basically, and so much more robust because you take away a lot of these side effects. So for people who don't know monad takes away side effects and the try catch block is one of them. The code became very, very robust actually. And so I took that along to other teams and a lot of teams find it hard to grasp first, especially if you, if you're a newer developer, basically, it's a harder concept to get. So the code is, the first time you see it, it's really different. People find that really hard, but once you get it, you actually never go back. So I would never write code anymore without having all this monadic stuff in it and all the lambdas and stuff. And it's just, it's a very different way of programming. I start all my functions writing the return word first, right? And I'm thinking, okay, what do I need to return? And how do I get there? And reasoning backwards instead of reasoning, let's do all this stuff, and eventually this comes out.
Yeah.
And it's very, very different style of programming.
I think that was something also that you said in your talk. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. The starting with the return, because that I found that was a very useful way of integrating something I'd already understood, but I had not thought of making explicit. And now that's what I'm absolutely going to tell people. But that other idea of the kind of the monadic, more monadic style, I think there's an interesting shift there, and it's. One of them is to do with the thing that you're abstracting. You know, it's like if you learn a procedural language, one of the first things that you have to learn to move on, you learn to do procedural abstraction. You know, you just like, I can pull out procedures. Although that, not everybody does that. I do remember the time I had to teach a Fortran programmer. I was teaching them C, and I said, oh yeah, functions in C. And I said, you know, the concept is like, you know, subroutines and functions in Fortran, which I knew. And I was using that as a kind of point of engagement. They said, I don't think I've ever written one of those. It's like they used to write everything in just one big routine. So they'd never really started. So for them, the big boundary was actually procedural abstraction was the first step. They had not yet decomposed that. And then we start hitting data approaches that start talking about our data, and you know, object orientation as a data abstraction technique. Yeah. And so in other words, we have procedural abstraction, we have data abstraction. And then we start moving into other spaces, and you've got control flow abstraction, which is behavior. Effectively what you're describing. Yep. It's just full behavior, but not necessarily a data-driven. It's not driven from the data. It's driven by something else.
Yep.
And perhaps that's a little less visible to people. That's why they find it disorienting.
Oh, yeah. Likely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like you're actually offering a different. It's not just a different construct. It's actually a different abstraction universe.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And that can be, you know, I can understand that's disorienting, but yeah, it's quite powerful when you get
is.
That way.
It is extremely powerful, actually, but it is disorienting, that's true. And when I first met with it in like 2015, and I didn't realize that actually the full possibilities of doing this. Like, we only had the try class, right? And despite the fact that Java has the optional thing in it, right, which is a... Well, it's basically a poor man's monad, but it doesn't do much. But and they could go so much further with it. And I did a talk at a Java conference in November, and I'm like, guys, you guys have lambdas for like what is it, a decade now or something?
2014,
Java 8 or something, right?
Yeah.
And so you should be able to write much more monadic code, and people are like, yeah, but that's not how you write Java. And I'm like, yeah, well, you can. So, yes, it is. I'm like, no, we write it like this. And I'm like, okay. Those are the people that go to the same campsite for 25 years, right? It's like, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just, yeah, well, you can do so much more with it. And it's even like, well-known Java developers had these discussions on Twitter or something, or why don't you solve this problem and try some monadic stuff to it instead of writing all these stupid if statements. And they're like, no, but this is how we write Java. Okay.
This is how we've always done it.
Yeah, right, exactly that. So that's why Java's becoming a new COBOL, basically. And
speaking of which, actually, the wonderful Grace Hopper, who was responsible for the invention of COBOL, she did actually have this wonderful quote, which was, people hate change. People are fond of always saying, we've always done it this way.
Yeah.
And she said, that's why I have a clock on my wall that goes counterclockwise. We don't always have to do it this way. This is the whole point. And I think that again, it's that kind of incomplete knowledge. It's that notion of going around a cycle that brings that. So... In closing, I do want to pick up on that point about the return statements, because I think that's quite an interesting one, because I've seen that with, as it were, I found it a helpful technique sometimes with test writing is write not the return, but write your assertions and then work back. In other words, what's the journey that got me to this point?
Yeah.
And the same actually applies to return statements, and actually makes simpler something I've found people have been, in the last decade or so, have been making their control flow far more complex, having gone through the structured programming revolution and understood why it was actually important, I'm finding people are doing a lot of unstructured programming. You're just like, this is really imperative programming. It's very, very, it's not quite assembler, but kind of object-oriented assembler. Mm. And they've got very, very messy control flow. And it's just like, actually, what do you want to return from this? Oh, we're going to do this, do this, do this, which as you talked about, you mentioned it in your talk. It's a very procedural approach. This is what I'm doing, as opposed to what do I want to receive? Let's turn the question around. And that gives you a much simpler thing. There's a flow there that will come more naturally.
Yeah. It's like you turn around the funnel, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that drawing out why does this abstraction exist, therefore what do I want from it, let's start with that question rather than what am I doing.
Yeah.
Well, we can organize that into the flow, and if we can't, we've just learned something. You know, I think that's a very, you know, again, that comes from a question approach.
Yeah.
It allows us to reshape based on questions.
I guess that's basically what I do, right? If you would summarize it, is I ask questions. Whatever I'm doing, also what I'm doing myself, right? Also ask my question, is this what I want to do? Is this what I find important, right? Like, And I think I do that with most of the stuff in my life. Just wonder, why am I doing this? Am I doing this because I like to? I actually narrow down the things I do, the way I spend my time, because there's always more that you can do, with not just with code, but with everything, then you have time for it. So what do you want to spend your time on? And I don't have to plan that. I take that like in every day. Like, a simple example, there's a speaker's dinner tonight. I didn't register for it because on Mondays I normally have my kids. And then for some reason, actually my mother-in-law died last week, so my kids are now with their moms, as they should be, which all of a sudden opens the opportunity. Do I want to go to the speaker's dinner? And I'm like, yeah, why not? So, it's a matter of how do you spend your time. So I ask myself, what would I do tonight if I wouldn't go to the speaker? I'd probably go to the cinema or have a beer somewhere on a terrace here in the city. But having speakers is also fun. So let's do that, right? And I try to spend as much time as I can with my mother. She's 83. She's in a wheelchair. She has one leg. She gave me a lot of attention during my life, so I think she deserves to get my priority right. So I do, not always, but I do. I try to do that right. So and it's there's a very limited amount of things that I love to spend time on, but they're very deliberate choices. And that's I'll give you one more example. So we were in Belfast, as you know, right? Like a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, indeed. Where you also learned. You learned
right.
Something. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, as a big Led Zeppelin fan, I should have known, right? But I didn't know that until you mentioned it, like the Giant's Causeway being the Houses of the Holy cover. But so we figured out when we were in Belfast, there was a performance of the Holy Grail. I don't know, it's called a folio, I think, right? Where you make the noises yourself. So it was in a church. And so I raised my kids with Monty Python, as you should. And coincidentally, all three of them were there. And I said, we are going to go to this show, right? So we phoned up and they were fully booked. And then we said, well, we come specifically from the Netherlands to go to this show. And they were like, oh yeah, we'll pull up five chairs. And so we went there and there were people coming in with, it's called a habit in English as well, where monks wear and stuff, with wooden boards to hit themselves in the head. And so it was, I had a tremendous laugh. And then I went out and the woman from the show said, well, this must have concluded your upbringing of your kids. I said, yes, I'm now fully. So we're we're traveling and we're seeing Monty Python in a church in Belfast, which is done. I'm complete.
That's brilliant. So there is nothing that I can say that will follow that, except thank you very much. That's a perfect ending. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.